Yet his reservation was there in the computer, along with Wilcox's credit data, absolutely authentic. Dan saved the tired young man the embarrassment of asking. "Damnedest thing," he said, trying to remember what a Texas twang sounded like. "I've been coming up here for years. Usually stayed at the Astro Habitat, you know, because I'm on company business. One of their biggest goddamned investors, and I like to see what they're doing with my money, you better believe. But ever since that GEC gang took over, you know, there's so many new people over to Astro that they just don't have room for one of their investors anymore. Can you imagine that? I spent the whole damned day arguing with them and half the night waiting for them to come up with some decent accommodations for me and my two assistants. Finally, I told them, fuck it. I'll get over to Yamagata's. They know how to treat a visitor." He asked where the nearest computer link was. Looking somewhat dubious, the clerk pointed to the phone console at the end of the registration desk. Dan went to it, tapped into the Astro accounting system, and had $10,000 transferred to the hotel in the name of Roger Wilcox. Then he asked the clerk to give him cash. $10 $1,000 bills, please. The clerk's expression went from dubious to curious. Hardly anyone used cash on the moon. But he read his own computer screen carefully, saw that the money was in Mr. Wilcox's account, then unlocked the cash drawer and counted out the money. "I appreciate your help very much, son," drawled Dan, handing one of the bills back over the counter to the room clerk. He hesitated a heartbeat, glanced over his shoulder as if afraid the manager was watching, then snatched the $1,000 note. The young man bowed and smiled with pleasure. "My friends will be along directly," Dan said, hoping he wasn't overdoing the accent. "Please see that they get to my suite." He said nothing about luggage, leaving the clerk to assume that his two assistants would be carrying it. Like stout Cortez, when with eagle eyes he first stared at the Pacific, TV reporter Harvey Yates struck a pose and gazed out on the glittering blue sea. The other two members of the news crew, cameraman and audio woman, knew that Harvey was already rehearsing how he wanted to look on the videotape they were here to shoot. Their two Eskimo guides paid attention not to Yates's pose, but to the shining new space-age parka that each of the news team wore, light yet warm, stylish and brilliant of hue. They were not jealous so much as covetous of those expensive, handsome parkas. It was too warm to keep the hood up. Besides, Yates knew, he would look better on the tape with the hood down, and his golden hair catching the slanting rays of the sun that barely rose above the horizon. "Don't look like much," said the cameraman. "Just a stretch of water and some of those flat ice floes out in the distance." "Moron," snapped Yates. "Up here the ocean freezes over. Open water at this time of year is unheard of." The cameraman shrugged. "Still don't look like much." "It's the greenhouse effect. There's hardly any ice in the whole Arctic Ocean." "What was all that white stuff we flew over?" asked the audio woman, grinning at the cameraman. They were both accustomed to Yates's exaggerations. "Oh, further out, yeah, sure. But it ought to be solid ice all the way up to the shore here." The reporter turned to the two Eskimos. "Isn't that right?" One of the Eskimos, who held a degree in climatology from the University of Alaska, nodded solemn agreement. "There hasn't been this much open water here at this time of the season in the memory of living man." "See?" said Yates. "It still don't look like much," argued the cameraman. "Just some water. We could get a shot like this in New Jersey, for Christ's sake." Yates screwed up his handsome features into a dark scowl. His crew people knew that he was thinking, not angry. "Okay," he said. "How about this? I take one of those little kayaks and paddle out to the ice floes. You shoot me from here. Show how far away the ice really is." "I wouldn't do that," said the climatologist. Yates waved him down. "I've done plenty of kayaking. Went down the length of the Grand Canyon last year." The cameraman brightened. "Yeah, we could set up a remote on the kayak, just like we did then." The audio woman nodded agreement. The two Eskimos glanced at one another. They tried to argue against it, but Yates would not listen. "We've only got a couple hours of sunlight left, right? We're not going to stay here until the sun comes up again. That'd take months, right? So stop arguing and get me a kayak." Thus it was that, as the pale Arctic sun touched the flat horizon of sea and ice, Harvey Yates paddled a kayak out to the nearest of the ice floes. A remote camera attached to the boat's prow trained on his tousle-haired face, a remote microphone catching every word of his non-stop narration. Thus it was that an orca, driven close to the shore by hunger because the seals had been largely killed off, rushed up from the depths, overturned Yates's kayak, and crushed him in its jaws. The cameraman and audio woman stood on the shore, aghast, but recording every instant of Yates's untimely death. The two Eskimos looked at one another sorrowfully, grieved by the loss of that spanking new parka. The mass driver stretched in a straight line for slightly more than 2 miles across Mare Nubium, just outside the Ringwall Mountains of Alphonsus. The original planners of the Alphonsus complex assumed that workers at the mass driver facility would be quartered in the city and commute to their jobs via the cable car system that crossed the Ringwall. Over the years, however, a small, makeshift, rugged community grew around the mass driver facility. Men and women lived there for months or even years at a time, going to Alphonsus City only for vacations or to return earthward. Except for the long straight track of the electric catapult itself, the mass driver complex was underground, a warren of interconnected shelters and tunnels. One of the shelters housed the complex's only bar, named 100 G's, after the nominal acceleration that the mass driver imparted to its cargo containers to fling them into space trajectories. Tamara Duchamp did not feel comfortable at 100 G's. She was accustomed to the more refined cabarets of Paris or the quiet lounges of Alphonsus City. The bar felt rough and rowdy to her. The men who gathered there were little better than grease monkeys for the most part, and miners who drifted in from the camps farther out on Mare Nubium looking for a night's entertainment. The women were hardly better. Tamara seldom went to the bar, but after weeks of living in this dreary underground nest, exiled from the comforts of the city, she found herself driven by loneliness, the need for some human companionship. The 100 G's was crowded, smoky, noisy with raucous talk and blaring canned music, but she went there anyway. There was no place else to go. She never dressed provocatively. Usually she wore plain coveralls, as she did this evening. Yet not even the drabbest of outfits could hide the lithe grace of her long-legged body or the sculptured dark beauty of her face.
"Hey, princess, you drinking alone?"
Tamara looked up from the minuscule table to see a lanky, red-faced guy with a bushy mustache grinning at her, almost leering at her. The name badge on his breast said Rollins. His shoulder patch identified him as an electrical engineer.
"The place is awful crowded," he said, not giving her a chance to answer. "Mind if I sit with you?"
Again without waiting, he took the chair next to hers and pulled it close. He already had a tall drink in one hand.
"My name's John, without an H. I'm from Oklahoma, where the wind comes whistling down the plain."
Tamara hesitated, then said, "My name is Tamara."
"Wow, sexy name. Where are you from?"
"I was born in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia."
"Wow," he repeated, "like out of the Arabian Nights."
Tamara sipped at her drink, thinking how ironic it was that she badly wanted some company, but wanted even more badly to be rid of this lout. Scanning the crowd clustered thickly around the bar, her eyes smarting from their smoke, ears hurting from the noise of their so-called music, she desperately wished she were back in Paris, or at Alphonsus, working for Dan. No matter what his reputation, he was civilized.
"How'd you like to take a little walk outside? See the earth? It's real romantic."
"From inside a pressure suit?"
"Ever done it in a suit?"
Tamara put her unfinished drink down on the table.
"Excuse me, I'm leaving."
"What? You just got here, didn't you?"
She pushed through the crowd and the smoke and the noise, heading for the door.
"Just a minute, lady."
Someone grasped her shoulder. The man turned her around. It was not John from Oklahoma. This man had a lean face like a weasel and sallow skin. He did not look like one of the workers from the mass driver, and certainly not a miner. Too slick. And he wore a business suit instead of the coveralls that the workers wore.
"You're coming with me. We've got things